Welcome back, everybody, to Conduct Detrimental. I'm Daniel Wallach, joined always by my co-host, Dan Lust. And joining us today, Taryn. Thank you. So we're the three-headed, you know, show of Conduct Detrimental, and it's one of the most important weeks personally in the lives of one of our co-hosts. Dan Lust not only had a birthday this week, not only has been retweeted probably hundreds, if not thousands of times, but his wife gave birth to their second child, who is bestowed with one of the most memorable names in the history of names, Sloan Lust. Daniel, congratulations on the wonderful occasion and on the, you know, terrific choice in names. I love the name Sloan Lust. She will never, ever be asked the following question by any human being in history. Excuse me, what is your name again? That will never happen. It will be emblazoned in everyone's memory forever. That is one of the all-time great names. So congratulations and mazel tov, Dan.
I'm curious what you mean by one of these most memorable names. Her last name had to be Lust, and Sloan is a beautiful name. Are you saying that the name Sloan has some connotation that I was not aware of? Because I already signed the birth certificate, Dan. I already signed it.
Well, I mean, you could have named her like Rebecca Lust or Shoshana Lust.
No, but let's focus on the Sloan part. What is wrong with the name Sloan?
Nothing. It's two single syllable names that flow really well together. Sloan
Watch this.
Lust. It's almost, she doesn't have to change her name if she becomes an actress.
Watch this. How about Dan Lust? Does that work?
Is that your real name, Dan? Lust?
My real name is Daniel.
No, Lust. Was that your family, your father's given name? Or was it like changed on like the New York when they came over to the United States? That is like one of the all-time
family business.
This was not an Ellis Island type deal. Lust has been our name as far back. So my understanding is that indulgent means happy or something close to translating to happy. And I'm a happy guy. Dan, I think you're walking a very close line to slandering an infant, but you know, it's okay. I love you. So, yeah, I'm just kidding.
But Dan, that's not even the most memorable name in the family.
I know what you're getting at. I'm going to cut this off immediately. My mom's name is Lois. She also has to have a first name, okay? It is not her fault, nor my daughter's fault that our last name is Lust. It's actually not even a fault. It's like a blessing. It's a mitzvah that they have such a cool last name.
Absolutely.
I mean, Dan, is your mom's name Wendy Wallach? I mean, that's pretty memorable.
No. No, but Vita Wallach. Vita Wallach, may she rest in peace. I love my mother is amazing. Vita is Spanish for life. So she was given a great name. She also is one of those people where once you meet her and she tells you her name is Vita, you probably don't forget that either. But Lois Lust and Sloan Lust are at the very top of the pyramid of memorable names.
Let's cut this off because I am getting a little bit uncomfortable with where this conversation is getting. And, you know, it is my last name. It is real. We do run a sports law show. And Dan, you know, as much as it's a big week for me personally, it's a really big week for all the listeners of the podcast, all the observers of our content on social media. The website has exploded in a way that I don't think any of us really predicted. Right now, I think we're on day 10 of the website. It has already exceeded 4,500 views. It'll probably be at 5,000 by the time you guys are listening to the podcast. We have 20 article submissions. We have a bunch more in the queue. We're just trying to space them out so everyone can get their fair runtime on the site, but it's really been a blessing. So we wanted to really kind of take the podcast today and a number of topics. We're going to go with the top topic of week one on the website, top topic from week two on the website, and then we're obviously going to hit some big stories. So here's the roadmap for today, and we'll try to go in this order, try to stick to it as close as possible. So the kind of breaking news and a story that's not NIL, you know, it's not NCAA versus Alston. It's an issue about conference realignment, which if anybody remembers in the sports law pantheon, was probably one of the biggest stories in the last decade. Schools leaving different conferences, going different places. My very lovely Nebraska at one point left the Big 12, went to the Big 10. Texas A&M went from the Big 12 and went to the SEC. So we had a period of conference alignment a couple years ago, and it really kind of shifted the powers of college football in a way that we hadn't seen. So the top story that we're going to cover is Texas and Oklahoma, two of the storied programs in the Big 12. At least reports are that they are making affirmative moves to defect from the Big 12 and go to the SEC, which is already the most powerful football conference in the country. Number two, Conor McGregor had a recent loss, you know, at UFC, that is a big fight about a week ago. Top story from our Conduct Detrimental, at least in the all-time records, maybe someone will top it. A story by John Nucci over at Penn State, how Conor McGregor knew ahead of time going into the fight that he had an injury, but that was not disclosed to anybody, maybe outside of UFC, Dana White, and the doctors. Number three, another story from Conduct Detrimental, the top story of this past week, another story by Britton Yoder and Sam Ruse over at Penn State. They wrote an article about how Shohei Ohtani, as this dual pitcher hitter, is basically not meant. It doesn't really make sense how he's going to fit into an arbitration equation. And he could basically rewrite all of the records that have ever been set in arbitration. And number four, passing of wrestling great Paul Orndorff. Dan's got a lot of thoughts on it. And obviously, Dan and I are very close to the wrestling world, so we want to get into that. With that said, Dan, I'm going to turn it to you. Texas, Oklahoma, Big 12, SEC. Take it away, my friend.
Yeah, this is a boatload of different legal issues. In the last year or two, I can't think of any story that has come down the sports law pike that raises and triggers as many different legal issues as this one does. You know, we have provisions under the SEC Constitution, the Big 12 bylaws, the enforceability and provisions under the Grant of Rights Agreement, the buyout clauses, withdrawal provisions, potential antitrust issues, a complete, I would say, a recasting of collegiate sports. This might be the most important sports law story that we're going to see in 2021 and a year that have just had plenty of them. But the question is, what happens after the vote? Is this going to end up playing out in the courts? I mean, you had a pretty, I wouldn't say controversial, but one that evoked a lot of reaction on Twitter. You raised the specter of a court potentially blocking, I guess, the transfer of Texas and Oklahoma from the Big 12 to the SEC. I personally don't see this as an injunctive relief situation. The question is the enforceability of some of these contractual provisions. I think the withdrawal clauses in the Big 12 bylaws allow for withdrawal by a member, but subject to very staggering penalties. So I'm not sure I see where the potential court involvement is in potentially blocking the move. And I know there are a few sports lawyers on Twitter that took issue with your suggestion that it might be blocked by a court with this action to go forward. I don't know that I take one side or the other on the issue, but I want to hear some of your thoughts on where you see a court intervening here to potentially derail this.
Yeah, so a couple things. You know, Dan, I'm very good at crafting tweets in order to gain some attention. If you read the actual tweet, it says the possibility that a court could block it. So I'll say friend of the podcast, I like Mitt Winter. He popped in and said, it's not possible. It's not going to get blocked. So possibility means it could happen or it could not happen. So I'm happy that Mitt read the article where it was not said that it would happen. But shout out to Joe Blessis over at Arizona State Law who wrote the article.
Terrific article, Dan.
Terrific article by Joe. Yeah, it was a really good job, very timely. And just so people know that are interested in writing for the website, we have about, you know, we have 20 people that have submitted articles. We actually have 6 articles in the queue right now. And if they're not, you know, so time sensitive, we just want to space them out. But Joe wrote an article. He basically got it to us within an hour of the news break. And so if you have something late and breaking, we will bring it to the top of the queue. And that article is probably going to end up, we'll say, in the top 3. Right now it's hovering around 5. But here was the comment. And the comment was actually from friend of the show, Gabe Feldman. So Gabe Feldman, the head of the Tulane sports law program, you know, he notes the potential implications of the move could lead to the potential determination that the conference has market power and thus any of their conference level agreements could pose antitrust issues. So, you know, maybe the move won't be blocked, but to the extent that the SEC starts to have a lot of market power, maybe there's a court. I'm not going to say it's impossible, right? If the SEC has all of the schools and they're just collecting Power 5 schools left and right, we've seen courts break up, you know, entities that have a lot of monopolistic power. So maybe they don't block the move, but maybe they render it inoperable after the fact. So just pointing out, like, this move has antitrust and monopolistic ramifications to it, but it's a fair question. And I think it's a fair issue to at least pose. And then I think it's way too early for anybody, Mitt or anybody else, to say, yeah, this won't have antitrust ramifications.
Yeah, I mean, how many conferences are there and how many, you know, major colleges are there? I don't see this as strong as the SEC is. I know it's the preeminent conference now, at least for collegiate football. I don't know if the other sports are as significant, but, you know, certainly there are other major conferences and everything's cyclical. Maybe in college football, the SEC is king, but that's not true in every sport. And these things shift over time.
I'm going to agree. I mean, it's somebody, I'll shout him out at some point while we're on this, but somebody pointed out, and I think it's probably the best argument, the counter, right? College football might have all the powerhouses, but when you go just to college basketball, right? The SEC is not the powerhouse there. If anything, it's probably the Big Ten. You know, I think that they had the most schools in the NCAA tournament last year. But yeah, I think that's a fair point, right? How many, I think there's 10 college football conferences. There's obviously the Power 5. So, I mean, I could make the argument that maybe it's a quote unquote monopoly within college football, but that conference for the most part is going to carry over sports, carry over to basketball and carry over to baseball and different sports down the line. So yeah, maybe that's the effective counterpunch. Maybe that's it, right? That it's not a monopoly over college sports as a whole.
There's a new issue that really is a game changer for the balance of power among the different conferences. The NIL issue in particular makes being a member of the SEC particularly lucrative. I mean, Nick Saban, I think, was commenting the other day that his quarterback has already generated more than someone who hasn't played a game yet. Maybe I'm not as well heard.
Allegedly, he has garnered that much attention. I don't think we've seen any actual confirmation of it. That might just be a Nick Sabanism. He might have just said that to say that.
Nick Saban doesn't strike me as somebody who's like prone to hyperbole. But regardless of that particular, you know, anecdotal information, collegiate football players who are part of the SEC are going to have, I would think, you know, more lucrative opportunities, more opportunities than most other schools would be able to generate. So it makes being a member of the SEC especially important, you know, for recruiting purposes. If you're in the Big 12, your ability to recruit colleges, you know, recruit players, you're at a competitive disadvantage in the post Alston world than if you were a member of the most, you know, probably successful collegiate football conference in the country. So I think there are some very compelling economic reasons for Oklahoma and Nebraska to move over. First of all, there's the television revenue. And then from a competitive standpoint, obviously, I think NIL plays a big role in the ability of those schools to recruit the best possible players and put them in a position to compete for national championships, even if the competition in the SEC is going to be much steeper than it was or would have been in the Big 12. They're stepping up in class, but they're going to be able to recruit a different or better caliber of player, even though they are one of the top, you know, most well-known collegiate programs in the country. They're just not what they used to be.
And I think that the expansion of the playoff also contributes to that. Now that there's going to be 12 teams, we know in the next couple of years that will be able to play in the playoff. It's not so much a concern that, oh, you have to win your conference. The SEC is pretty typically getting two teams in with only four spots available. So you can imagine that with 12 spots available, they might be able to get upwards of four. So I think that it does help, and it does help for the recruiting as well. I think that with Texas A&M being the only Texas school in the SEC, if you're a Texas athlete but you want to play SEC football, there was one spot to go to. Now there might be three spots to go to high-end, high-caliber schools. Yep. And to the basketball point, I do – the ACC is the preeminent basketball conference. They have the most national championships. The Big Ten hasn't won a national championship since 2000. So I think that this does help the SEC as a basketball conference as well. Texas just hired Chris Beard, who is an excellent coach and did really incredible things at Texas Tech. And I think that with the way that they're recruiting, they're building a new arena for basketball, that they could be a real power in the same way that Kentucky has been dominating the SEC for many years. The question that I wanted to bring up is that this will almost certainly go to court, I think, because I don't think that these schools are just going to volunteer to pay up, and the Big 12 is going to try to keep them, even though I think that the lasting damage might be done at this point. If you look at that, the Big 12 bylaws, and it's something that Joe pointed out, you have to pay the all actual losses, damages, costs and expenses. So the Big 12 just recently tried to renew their television broadcasting rights. And that, as we know, is the big moneymaker for all of these schools. That's where the money comes from. So with Texas and Oklahoma leaving, those are the two preeminent members of that conference of what remains. So would they be required to pay what the portion might be of a comparable broadcasting contract? And do you think that they would be willing to do that? Is it worth it to pay up that money to get out of the Big 12?
Just so people understand where the figures are coming from. Again, Joe Esses from Arizona State Law has an article up on conduct detrimental. And he's essentially saying that when you do the math, the actual amount that must be paid by Oklahoma and Texas is $100 million to the conference. Now, mind you, that's not $100 million to be split between the two. It's $100 million and $100 million. So, you know, do Texas and Oklahoma have $100 million just waiting to go? Do they think it's worth going to the SEC long-term? Could they make an actual, you know, $100 million? that remains to be seen, right? If if you read the Big Ten or Big 12 bylaws, it essentially says you have to make this type of payment if you leave the institution. So number one, I think we should all point out, and this is what I tried to point out in the thread, there is no guarantee that the SEC approves of Oklahoma and Texas. Why? And because Taryn, you make an excellent point. I don't want it to get lost here. Texas A&M made the move when there was conference realignment a couple years ago. They made the move from the Big 12. You know, they have these great rivalries with Kansas and Texas and Oklahoma, and they decided to leave to go to the SEC. Why? Because Texas A&M, and give credit to their athletic director who have made the decision, SEC football is a better brand of football. And it's, I think it's a higher quality football. They have the most first round picks constantly every year. But Texas football, Texas high school football, is a hotbed of talent. So if you wanted to play SEC football but remain in the state, boom, Texas A&M is going to grab a lot of great guys for that reason. Now, Oklahoma and Texas going to the SEC makes it a little bit less special. So number one, right, there has to be a vote. I think you have to get 11 SEC votes of the school to approve new members. I think that's what the bylaws say. You guys can correct me if that's not your interpretation of it.
But, you're correct. It's 11 out of 14, 75%.
The people that vote yes are basically voting to piss off Texas A&M. Texas A&M is almost going to be an automatic no. And then, you know, will they pay $100 million? So, yeah, if you get both schools paying $100 million, they're both willing to pay it, and everybody lets them into the SEC, sure. But those are two really big ifs. So, yeah, as much as they'd like to leave the conference, we don't have any confirmation that they're willing to pay the $200 million and that they'll actually be allowed in. So it's an issue that's not going to go away that quick.
Well, listen, now Texas A&M had the chance, you know, 9-10 years ago when they joined the SEC to insist on a contractual provision, or at least some kind of a written guarantee that they would be the only school from Texas. I've read that there's some, you know, notion of this gentleman's agreement because a number of the other SEC schools have an understanding that other schools from the same state aren't going to get the same opportunity to be admitted to the SEC, but this isn't even in writing. And for Texas A&M, you know, I guess president or athletic director to be as passionate about the defense and how terrible this would be for A&M, that when we went into the conference 10 years ago, this was the expectation. It was never reduced to writing. And I think at the end of the day, which is an overused expression, the amount of the value of the television contract with the addition of Texas and Oklahoma, two of the most historic programs in the legions and annals of college football, that's something that brings a lot economically to the table, maybe not immediately, but certainly for the next, you know, next negotiation of a TV contract, streaming rights. Those two schools add a lot of value. And I think at the end of the day, the other member schools will vote with their pocketbook and look at it economically rather than have any allegiance to the wishes of the administration of A&M, which should have had a contractual guarantee that it would be no other member school. So it does, I think the loyalty factor will yield to money. This is all about money, TV rights, and a piece of the pie, and a bigger piece of the pie.
Yeah, it always does. And from a fan's perspective, one benefit of Texas and Oklahoma going back is basically like getting the old Southwestern Conference back together. So a lot of those traditional rivalries that haven't been played since the Southwestern Conference broke up in the late 90s, that would be something cool to look forward to.
I guess in wrapping this up, Dan, just to recap on last podcast, we talked a little bit about the Maria Taylor, Rachel Nichols issue, and you know, I had some fun at Clay Travis's expense. You know what, Dan? I think we could still definitively say that Clay Travis is a friend of the podcast because, per sources, he just liked your tweet about the $1 billion damages clause. Dan, can you confirm that Clay Travis is still a friend of the show in its totality?
Yeah, Dan, I've been working overtime to try to salvage the Clay Travis conduct detrimental relationship in view of your attempted slam dunk over Clay Travis a week ago. One thing I'll always advise you, I'm very opinionated and you're very opinionated too, but I try to keep other media personalities and basically other people out of harm's way. So
again, to clarify, you are annoyed that I wrote Lust:1, Travis:0.
Not annoyed, just you know, some brotherly advice here that it'd probably be good to remain.
But Dan, this is like shake and bake. I maybe stepped in it a little bit, and then you pulled us out together. So I knew you were going to do that. I knew you were boys of Clay Travis. I knew everything was going to work out. We did it. And Dan, I have a question. Now, did you watch the NBA Finals this past week?
Sure did. Live from Russia at like 7 in the morning.
It actually was probably like 11 your time is actually probably a good time to watch it. But, you know, there was a very famous dunk that occurred in game five. It's a Giannis lob from Jrue Holiday, slammed it down. And all the pictures are of Chris Paul getting dunked on. So quick question. Who do you think was more annoyed that they got dunked on? Chris Paul or Clay Travis?
For sure, Chris Paul. I don't think Clay Travis has any kind of like he's like a relief pitcher or field place kicker who misses the game winning field goal. You just got to put it out of your consciousness like a second later.
See, but he might be the relief pitcher, but I'm the hitter that's hot dogging it around all the bases and pointing at him and doing like that little Conor McGregor walk.
People in this business could have long memories and no one likes to be dunked on. I don't know if he has thin skin or not. So it'd probably be a good idea just, you know, dealing with all media personalities, because listen, we appear on a number of different, you know, shows, and I've tried to get on Clay Travis's show in the past. We haven't made it happen yet, but it's always good to maintain good relationships with other people in the media, other legal analysts. So,
you know what?
A dangerous game to play, you know, given the power dynamic here. But I'll let you make the decision. I'm giving you all advice from all different sides.
Clay, if you're listening, listen, let's call this an unholy alliance, okay? We can be friends. That's fine. Yes. So let's do this one. I want to give it a special shout out to John Nucci. Again, similar to, and this is just maybe an evidence of the website. When people come out with a topic that is both timely and kind of a breaking story, and they come out with a timely, interesting take, those are our top articles on the entire site. So John Nucci came up with an article, and the title kind of sells it. I think that's probably part of it. Could Conor McGregor KO the UFC with a bombshell lawsuit? I saw the Instagram live that Conor posted. I didn't catch the issue. This is all really kind of finding a topic to write about, or even what we do on Twitter is all issue spotting. So Conor McGregor's on Instagram, and he's on his scooter. I don't know where he is. He's just kind of scooting around, I guess, California. I'm not sure where it is. And he goes, quote, "I was injured going into the fight. People are asking me, when was the leg broke? At what point did the leg break? Ask Dana White. Ask the UFC. Ask Dr. Davidson, the head doctor of the UFC. They knew I had a stress fracture in my leg going into that cage. It was debated about pulling that thing out." So that sounds like there was maybe an injury that occurred prior to the fight. That this was a big UFC event against Dustin Poirier, people will know, and Conor lost. Now, had that fight been pulled at the last minute, I think rest assured that UFC fans would have been unhappy. There would have been a lot less money in the UFC's pockets and Dana White's pockets. So Conor McGregor calling out Dana White, maybe not so atypical, but Conor McGregor calling out Dr. Davidson and specifying that he was the head doctor of UFC and alleging very clearly that these guys were aware of a stress fracture prior to this event occurring raises a lot of red flags. It just does. So John Nucci points out an article, you know, it's the joke that I make online, you know, the assumption of the risk. Did Conor McGregor sign off on this? And even if he did Dana White still have an obligation, you know, as the head of an organization or Dr. Davidson, to pull Conor McGregor if he had a stress fracture before the event? So a really interesting issue, bringing up, you know, potentially some gambling lawsuits and whatnot. Taryn, I know you have some thoughts here. And Dan, obviously you're the sports betting guru, so we got to hear from you as well.
Yeah, I think Nucci's point is well taken. It's the assumption of the risk. If he's talking about, you know, we had this debate, we had this discussion, it was known before, that seems to imply that he knew that there were these stress fractures in his leg, that additional damage could have occurred and was likely to occur given the nature of the sport. So I'm not sure how much of a case there is here. What is the duty for Dana White and for the chief medical officer for UFC to pull somebody out if a minor injury is known already?
It's a very important question here. Where is the licensing authorities here? Where was this contest held? Was it in Nevada?
Yeah, I believe it was Las Vegas.
I believe it was Las Vegas.
So where is the Nevada, you know, Athletic Commission or Boxing Commission? Isn't there a regulatory body that's supposed to sort of examine fighters, or at least, you know, the fighters have to undergo some type of pre-fight, you know, medical clearance? Is that just simply the UFC's call, or is there a role that the state regulatory body has to play in clearing fighters ahead of the event?
Just one point to your point. What Nucci points out in the article is that there was a Bellator fighter, Derek Anderson, who I believe had a fight in Connecticut and failed to disclose to the athletic commission that he was injured prior to the fight. So he actually received a suspension. So the question is, you know, maybe it was McGregor's duty and McGregor's duty alone to let the Nevada, you know, Gaming Commission made them aware of that. So I think that issue is certainly out there. But McGregor saying he knew, in addition to the doctor knowing and Dana White knowing, I don't, Dan, you're the betting expert over here. If McGregor knew of it, right, but Dana White knew and the doctor knew, does that kind of obviate McGregor's responsibility to let people know he had an injury?
Well, I think the gambling issue, you know, kind of goes over the same territory that all of those class action lawsuits over the Houston Astros cheating scandal. One thing has been made clear by the courts. These issues do not give rise to a private right of action in the name of gamblers who have allegedly suffered losses. There's no culpability by the MMA, the fighter, or any other party for gambling losses suffered by individuals who wager on a particular fight or fighter without knowing all of the details. This is not like securities law, or, you know, where you have like material omissions or misleading statements that investors rely upon that could give rise to private civil liability under the federal securities laws under Rule 10b-5 or Section 10b of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. We don't have a similar recognition of rights for the better. This falls under the same line of authority as the Bill Belichick case. And I think it's been pointed out in a number of decisions that there is no standing for a customer of a sports book to file suit against any of the sports federations or athletic participants over any kind of, you know, integrity issues or scandals arising out of the sport. The relationship is between the bettor and the sports book, the bettor and the casino. The third parties here, the leagues, the fighters, the athletes, don't owe any duty to bettors. So I think these lawsuits, you know, kind of run aground under existing case law precedent, which dates back several decades. And I think the most prominent case involves, current New England Patriots head coach Bill Belichick. Those lawsuits don't have any legs to them. And in this instance, I don't think there's an issue here in terms of potential liability to the bettors.
So, I mean, we had this type of similar issue that came up on the podcast, maybe a few months ago at this point, but with the Kentucky Derby results being overturned and bettors were suing Bob Baffert, that Mandaloon should have won that race because of the alleged doping or whatever you want to call it, the medication violation. So, yeah, I think the betting issue is kind of open and shut. And Dan, I had mentioned to you, I texted with friend of the show, Darren Revelle, about the betting issue. I said, that one seems pretty open and shut. But the interesting issue, which I don't know if we're going to see anything that comes of it, is the Athletic Commission issue, which we kind of touched upon, right? Whose obligation is it to tell the Athletic Commission? Does the UFC have an obligation? I mean, and maybe Conor McGregor has a separate obligation. Maybe the doctor has a separate, maybe there are three different people that made a mistake here. But again, this is alleging or assuming what Conor McGregor is saying is true. So you can kind of go back through the history of, you know, big fighters losing big fights. They come up with every excuse in the book. Maybe this is just Conor McGregor talking out of his you-know-what, but these are big allegations he's throwing around.
But the state athletic commissions, you know, have these inherent conflicts of interest. They're appointed by the governor, and Nevada is very dependent upon being able to lure, you know, major prize fights and mixed martial arts competitions. You don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. So unless an athletic commission is truly independent and activist and wants to really, you know, just send a message to the promoters by, you know, suspending them in the absence of that, I don't think these commissions are strong enough to, you know, ferret out this kind of, you know, medical information ahead of the fight. I think the fighter should be subjected to pre-fight examinations, independent examinations. And then if he has a broken leg or he has some kind of an injury, which is allowed to fester, I think that should be detected during examination. But that might be more aspirational than realistic. But I think there's a role here to be played by the state regulatory bodies rather than to trust a private entity that has hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue riding on the fighters' participation. So there's conflicts of interest that really do get in the way of honest dealing and dealing fairly with state regulatory bodies and right. The public.
The Nevada Athletic Commission said that McGregor never informed them of anything like this. So again, it's about who is responsible for that. They said that if they knew that this type of injury had already occurred, or that there was this opportunity for a more serious injury to happen, that they would have never let them fight. But that decision is to be made by the doctor. So again, if there's this debate, and it almost seems like McGregor, if he's aware of it, is giving some sort of informed consent to get in there and fight.
And quite candidly, McGregor talks a lot and says a lot of things.
That's what I was going to say. Right.
And has a history of outrageous statements, hyperbolic statements.
Yeah, it's part of the persona. Yeah.
His credibility at times leaves a lot to be desired. So I think to put so much stock into his post-fight statement, which comes across as excuse-making, this is sort of in the history of combat sports, there has been no bigger excuse-maker than Conor McGregor.
Deontay Wilder is getting very close to that crown, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, he's won, you know, the last four fights, he's 1-3. He's pretty much become, and I hope Conor doesn't listen to the next like 8 seconds, but Conor McGregor.
Cover your ear. Wait. Cover your ears, Conor. Cover your ears. Okay, Conor.
Conor McGregor. Conor McGregor seriously is on a fast track to becoming the Washington Generals of the mixed martial arts community in the UFC. He's very close to becoming a stepping stone for other fighters. He brings the heat. He brings the bodies. He brings in the viewers.
Brings in the dollars.
But he's pretty soon going to be a stepping stone for other fighters. And, you know, the public will keep buying him as a legitimate, you know, contender, as somebody who's a top fighter until maybe 1, 2, 3 more losses. But he's running out of excuses. You can't look at a fighter like that objectively, putting aside his persona and who he is. If you just look at the record, he's fought 4 times in the last 5 years, has only won 1 of the fights, has been knocked out or submitted or whatever 3 times. This is no longer the same fighter that terrorized the UFC opponents and was at the top of his game in 2015 and 2016. So I'll say it, he's prone to hyperbole, and the media just feeds off of it. And I think by extension, we're feeding off of it because we're talking about it. But the reality is, I think his credibility in terms of candor and truth telling is very, very tenuous.
So just to put a pin in it, Conor McGregor, within 24 hours, let's say within 48 hours of that comment, a little bit earlier, he told Dustin that Dustin's wife was in Conor's DM. So, you know, I'm not sure how much credibility Conor has, but also to Dan and Taryn, both of your points. And we have to bring up this issue because people have been asking, is there any legality here? So we have to address it. If there was any truth to what Conor said, that there was some massive cover up between Dana White and Dr. Davidson, if there was truth to it, the athletic commissioner would have already spoken out at this point. So the fact that they haven't done anything tells you probably a lot. Okay, that said, let us transition to our next topic. You know, just a really interesting one from the world of baseball. You'd have to be living under a rock not to hear the name Shohei Ohtani. Taryn, I liked your comments over on Twitter about the defense of Shohei Ohtani from Stephen A. Smith, who I don't know if he's a friend of the show. We've never really spoke about Stephen A. Smith, but Stephen A. Smith, a little bit of a controversial comment, basically said that Shohei Ohtani shouldn't be the face of baseball because English is not his first language. A little bit controversial. Stephen A. had to apologize and then had to apologize again. Not really a good look. And meanwhile, Shohei Ohtani has like the top selling jersey in all of baseball. Everyone's talking about Shohei Ohtani. So people that know baseball, Shohei Ohtani is like Babe Ruth on steroids. He's a guy that is one of the top pitchers in the game and the top hitters in the game. And he's not doing them separately. He's doing them simultaneously. Babe Ruth was a fantastic pitcher. And then he switched from his career and became a hitter. That's just how he did it. He pitched for the Red Sox, was a hitter for the Yankees. So when people say, hey, he could be a great pitcher and a great hitter, no one has ever done what Shohei Ohtani is doing. There was a player a couple years ago, if people will recall, Rick Ankiel was this really top pitching prospect that came up in baseball. And then he kind of flamed out as a pitcher and he transitioned to being a hitter and actually had a year or two where he was hitting a lot of homers. So his agent at the time, Scott Boras, had an arbitration case. The case was coming up and he said, Rick Ankiel is Babe Ruth. There is no comparison to Rick Ankiel. So he's going to make a lot of money. Scott Boras was not right in that assumption. Rick Ankiel did not break any records because he was not doing them simultaneously. Talk about hyperbole is correct. But now we have a scenario where we do have someone that's doing something that has never been done before, and that's Shohei Ohtani. So Britton Yoder and Sam Ruse, both, I think, incoming 1Ls at Penn State. So credit to them. They have the second most popular article on the site. Number one and number two articles on the website, both from Penn State. Shout out to Penn State. If Dylan Harriger and Hayes Rule are listening to this, you might need to redo your top 10 sports law programs and rocket Penn State up that list because they have the top two most read sports law articles, at least on our platform. So, yeah, Taryn, I'll kick it to you with this. in the history of arbitration, what we do, and you know, I've competed in Tulane. I've actually helped the Cincinnati Reds with their arbitration cases in a prior job in the Oakland Athletics and one of my prior employers. But what you do is you look at players that are first-year eligible players, second-year eligible arbitration players, or third-year arbitration eligible players. You look at similar players and similar statistics, and that's how you figure out what the contract should be. It's a fun exercise. That's what the Tulane Baseball Arbitration Competition is like. It's a very fun exercise. The problem is there are no comparables to what Shohei Ohtani is doing. Maybe there are pitching comparables. Maybe they're hitting comparables. But what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to combine them together. But anyway, Taryn, I'll kick it to you. It's such a great issue that these two guys spotted. Credit, all the credit in the world to them. You know, it's a really fascinating issue.
Britton and Sam, that's just an excellent article. Really enjoyed reading it. And one thing that they do really well, I think, in this article is that they lay the groundwork so that anybody would be able to understand the arbitration process. But just for anybody who's listening that might not be aware, so right now, Ohtani is under contract. This year, he's making $3 million, and then next year, he'll be making $5.5 million. So he cut a deal with the Angels to avoid the arbitration process. So next year, it's not going to matter. But in 2 years, when he is going to be arbitration eligible, it could matter. So currently, he's leading the league in wins above replacement, which is a great catch-all statistic. And his counting stats are excellent. He's leading the league in home runs as well. I think that it's going to be most important to see whether he can repeat this. The reason that nobody's ever done this, it's not that there were not good players that were good enough to pitch and had very live arms, but were also athletic enough to hit. But it's more that the amount of care that it takes to prepare yourself to pitch and prepare yourself to be a major league hitter, it's just very intense, and it requires the buy-in from the team. I think that the argument that they make, which is really good, is that basically he is two excellent players in one. And so if he's able to repeat this next year during his platform year, I think that he could easily surpass the $27 million that Mookie Betts got. It'll be interesting to see by how much. Maybe upwards of $30 million sounds right. And then who knows what he would fetch once he hits free agency. But yeah, he's been so fun to watch. I may be able to see him in person on Saturday for the first time. And I'm so excited.
Well, I mean, let's look at some of the money, or from the financial side of it, what Ohtani means to the Angels. When he pitches, they draw on average 4,000 more fans per game, and that number is only going to go up. As his hitting exploits reach and maybe even exceed Ruthian proportions, this is going to have a seismic impact on attendance at the games. And then when you factor in the value that he has to the franchise in terms of the valuation of the team, his following in Japan, this is a player that is unlike any that has come along in my lifetime in terms of what he might mean to a market and to a franchise. I mean, I'm old enough, or I lived in New York during the Dwight Gooden era, when Dwight Gooden was a phenom, 1985, 1986, Ron Guidry, 1977. I remember that, you know, many are called, few are chosen. Ohtani is one of those players, and it is not hyperbole to think of Ohtani being a $50 million a year arbitration award winner, particularly if you factor in the off the field stuff. And I don't think that comes into play, but you know, another season like this one, if he's in the 50, 60 home run territory and he's winning 15, 20 games and he's impacting games two different ways and basically elevates the franchise, which hasn't won anything, by the way, You're talking not only shattering records, but approaching levels that were unheard of, that are unheard of for an arbitration award.
If he hits 60 homers, right, I'm not even talking about pitching, he will break the records. But I don't think he needs to do that. I think, to Taryn's point, if he's compensated as a pitcher, what a part-time pitcher, what a starting pitcher would do, and what an upper echelon hitter would do, if you just merge those two numbers, I think he breaks the records. Now, Dan, if he hits 60 homers, I mean, he's going to break the records irrespective. Mookie Betts never hit 60
that's
homers.
That's absurd, yeah. 60 yeah. would be
How long is his contract for? I'd like to see him become a free agent at some point. You know, so often with some of the great players, they get locked up early. And they get locked up early in the careers that basically go deep into their free agency period. I'd like to see what kind of, in a true free agency, what a player like Ohtani, if he were available this year or next year, would get in free agency, would be higher than $50 million for sure.
with him, one of the things that was very attractive to Major League Baseball teams when he was first posted is the fact that he was posted younger than what the threshold is that would make you an international free agent. So he was going to be ARB eligible. I think that was one of the most attractive things to the teams. And to his credit, like, it makes sense to take the deal that he took at the time. 2 years, $8.5 million. Maybe you're underpaid, but the fact is that even though he won Rookie of the Year in 2018, he was hurt, so he couldn't pitch. And this is really the first season that he's put it all together. And I think that that's what makes this so unbelievable, is that he's really carrying this team. Their best player, Mike Trout, who is, you know, unbelievable. You can't stay on the field right now. So what Ohtani is doing is just, like, so important to the team. And then you bring up his popularity. He just signed one of those exclusive memorabilia deals with Fanatics, and they've got them with a few other players, including Zion. And that's the type of player that we're talking about, somebody that's all world.
Well, he becomes a free agent in 2024. And I think some experts and people who have opined on the issue said if he were a free agent today, his annual contract value would be between 50 and 60 million. And as a New York Yankees fan, I got to tell you, this always strikes me as sort of the turning point in the recent history of the New York Yankees, because he was expected. The Yankees were the favorite in the year that he was going to be posted. I think there was almost an assumption that he would go to the New York Yankees, given the positive history that the Yankees had with Hideki Matsui. And when he spurned the Yankees, they didn't even make the final cut. I think it was 8 teams or 10 teams.
It was all West Coast teams.
Yeah, the Yankees then pivoted and made the Giancarlo Stanton trade, which has now saddled the Yankees with his unmovable contract for the next 7 years. So if you want to look at sort of where the Yankees went wrong and how their lineup is not, is inflexible, too many power hitters. It's not like the way the Yankees used to be, where they grind out at bats, Paul O'Neill, Scott Brosius. Ohtani's spurning of the New York Yankees was an important, demarcation in where the Yankees as a franchise have gone wrong.
I guess I could put a pin in the conversation. It's a really important, it's not an issue that's going to be decided today or tomorrow, but just know that we are watching history really occur. So if you're not, if you've maybe been tuned out to baseball the past couple of years, Shohei Ohtani is doing something different that we have never seen, the likes of which, maybe like the 98 baseball, home run chase or the Barry Bonds home run chase. This is something that's never been done. So you have arguably two of the top players in baseball playing for the same team, which is I think really special. So,
okay. The answer is Rick Ankiel. What's the question?
Who was a player that I named as a Scott Boras client like 5 minutes ago?
That's correct.
Who was a pitcher that got the yips, went down, and made it back to the major leagues as a hitter?
That's also correct. But the question is, name one out of the two players that Tony La Russa is responsible for ruining. Can you name both players?
No.
Can you name both players? And do you know what I'm getting at?
Yes.
When I lay blame at the feet of Tony La Russa for ruining the career of Rick Ankiel, and also probably ruining the career of Yermín Mercedes, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Do you know what happened with Rick Ankiel? His story is, of course, he got the yips, but Tony La Russa has some culpability here, because and it's one of the probably the single greatest regret of La Russa's career. He started Rick Ankiel, I think it was in game one of the National League Division Series playoffs in 2000. And it was a high pressure, high anxiety type of start. And there was another pitcher that was supposed to start in his place. And instead, La Russa gave the ball to Ankiel. And of course, he started throwing wild pitches all over the place and then couldn't get anybody out. The next start, the same thing. And it ruined him as a pitcher. This was a pitcher that had Cy Young, potential, one of the great arms. And La Russa threw him into a position, into the spotlight, maybe a little bit too early in his career. I'm not saying La Russa is completely at fault, but I think that's a situation where the player was not handled properly. And to his credit, Ankiel left the game, but he clawed his way back in and became a very productive hitter. And one of the most unusual careers in the history of Major League Baseball.
Okay, so that'll take us to our fourth topic. Dan, I know it's a topic that's near and dear to your heart, the era that you grew up in. That's Mr. Wonderful, Paul Orndorff. Take it away, Dan. I don't want to take it away from you. Go ahead.
Listen, today the WWE is a sort of a multi-billion dollar enterprise. For all intents and purposes, it's the only major professional wrestling federation, the only one that really matters, the only one that generates the kind of ratings and the kind of money. And a long time ago, wrestling was sort of broken down along regional lines. It was the Florida territory, the Georgia territory. There's a WWE in the Northeast. There was a death in the world of professional wrestling last week. Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, who during the 1980s was probably one of the most impactful wrestlers in all of wrestling. And the WWE was basically built on the back of guys like, you know, Rowdy Roddy Piper, Cowboy Bob Orton, obviously Hulk Hogan. But Paul Orndorff was one of the most central figures in the transitioning of the WWE, which at the time I think was called the WWF. He was one of the key players that elevated that federation and brought it into the big time, to the first WrestleMania and to where it is today. Orndorff was a very believable professional wrestler. He played college football at the University of Tampa, was a 12th round draft choice of the New Orleans Saints, looked the part of a great professional wrestler, bodybuilder, really chiseled like a wall of granite. And he brought a mentality and a physicality to the wrestling matches that really took the WWE to the next level. And as is the case with so many wrestlers, as they get a little bit older, you know, they're disposed of and the WWE just washes their hands of them. And he died after a long bout. He had cancer, dementia. If you took a look at Paul Orndorff in the last couple of years, he was a shell of his former self. And what really got to me, and I wasn't a big Orndorff fan when I followed wrestling, he was certainly somebody that I respected, and he was part of my sort of viewing when I followed wrestling in the mid-1980s. He died almost penniless. They had to raise money through a GoFundMe page to pay for Paul Orndorff's funeral expenses. And I know, Dan, you weren't watching wrestling in the 1980s, but the golden era of professional wrestling, certainly for the WWE, WWF, was the 1980s when Roddy Piper and Hulk Hogan ascended. Sort of they became mainstream media stars. Cyndi Lauper, when she was a pop star, made appearances on the program. And it all culminated in the first WrestleMania, which to this day is sort of the turning point for what catapulted the WWE into the big time. And Paul Orndorff was a very significant part of that. And it just really left me shaken to see him, you know, look the way he did, and to have his family have to raise money through a GoFundMe page to pay for his funeral expenses. He made the WWE. He made millions for the Federation. And I was just really angry that Vince McMahon and the WWE didn't step up in some fashion to pay for his funeral expenses. And it really underscores part of the problem with the combat athletes, boxing, wrestling, mixed martial arts. I understand that boxers are independent contractors. They're not employed by anybody, but I think professional wrestlers, particularly given the level of control that the WWE has over the fights, the working conditions, the outcomes, that these fighters continue to be treated as independent contractors. And as a result, they don't have any job protections, job benefits, pension plans, or the kind of long-term medical coverage that could provide care for these athletes. And they truly are athletes. You know, the results might be scripted, but there's nothing fake about the aches, the pains, and the long-term injuries that they face. And I think Paul Orndorff just struck a chord with me as to, Jesus Christ, we're supporting the WWE, and we watch these great athletes, but there's also the other side of it, which is what happens to them later in their lives. And it's really tragic.
Dan, I appreciate that. And I think, Dan, you know, people should go back in the archives. Dan has a long episode prior to me coming on. It's probably in April of last year, where Dan kind of dug into the, you know, the issues with the, you know, the NFL retirement plan and what those athletes were getting. So I know, Dan, this topic in particular is very, very close to you. I do want to say one thing, and I do, you know, kind of like looking ahead, what do we do with this, right? This has been a WWE issue for decades, right? This is not something new. I obviously wasn't born in the 80s, but I consider myself, this might sound shocking to some, a little bit of a wrestling historian. I know all the eras of wrestling, territorial area, then it, you know, kind of went, it merged into WWE, then there was WCW and ECW, all that fun stuff. But this issue of not
giving, you know, wrestlers proper benefits and pensions. That's always been an issue, and it's been an issue in every single foundation you could possibly imagine. Now, the one thing I wanted to correct you on, Dan, the WWE is no longer the only show in town. It's a fairly new development. You know, probably the last year or so, people are following it. People now will know there's a company called AEW that was started by the Khan family. It's the owner of the Jacksonville Jaguars. They're very, you know, they're very well off. And they've started to siphon WWE talent one by one. Chris Jericho, The Big Show. No, I don't want to get into my wrestling nerddom, but they're taking a lot of talent from the WWE, a lot of names that people, at least in the space, have heard of. So that said, I don't think AEW is promising wrestlers benefits and whatnot, but it's improving incrementally. So I think, you know, when Dan, you and I, we go on these, when we talk about antitrust, we talk about monopolies. I think WWE had something very, very close to a monopoly for years. And maybe it was antitrust concerns. There was just no show in town ever since Vince McMahon bought out WCW and ECW, kind of folded Paul Heyman's enterprise. But, you know, kind of like looking ahead, right? How did WWE get away with this? Because the wrestlers have always been, quote unquote, independent contractors. So WWE will say, well, we don't exert control of them. They're independent contractors. So we have another show in town, AEW. Competition is always good for stuff like this. Sure. You know, people that maybe aren't familiar with wrestling, but you understand college sports, right? We keep talking about the NIL era is going to be a boom for, you know, for these college athletes, because for years, maybe there was a little bit of a monopolistic argument or monopolistic kind of forces occurring. No one was paying athletes anything. So, you know, you couldn't improve the athlete experience, really. You know, maybe you could do it incrementally, but not in wholesale, because schools weren't competing for talent. So WWE is leaps and bounds behind college sports, obviously behind the pros, but you have another competitor popping up. So maybe you keep moving that direction. Maybe Dan, today's Paul Orndorff is not the same, 20 years from now. Maybe they'll have pension. Maybe they'll have disability benefits.
Yeah, but I think the recent NIL explosion and the new rights that have been granted to 18 to 21 year old, collegiate athletes really underscores to me, or shows the dichotomy of, you know, we focus on people at the very beginning of their professional lives. But as we see in the National Football League and boxing and now wrestling, I wish there was more attention and more rights and more equity and fairness in how these organizations, which profit to the tune of millions of dollars off of the backs of these athletes, how there's a lack of accountability and there aren't proper benefits or termination payments or post-termination benefits made available to these players. They don't have any access. They're completely on their own as independent contractors. And when you age out in professional wrestling, there's no pension plan, there's nothing. You're just left with your long-term disability. At least NFL players have a bargaining unit called the National Football League Players Association. As ineffective as it is, there is at least some modicum of collective bargaining, but these professional wrestlers, which are largely, you know, left to work for only one federation, or maybe now two, are bereft of any kind of collective bargaining and arguably face greater peril to their health, you know, wrestling 6-7 times a week, enduring the kind of damage to their bodies, their backs, their brains. From you see what they do. There's nothing fake about the impacts that their bodies and heads take during the course of a scripted or improvised match. And I, you know, I just like to, I don't know, I'm sympathetic to the plight of retiring wrestlers and what happens to these athletes when the cheering stops. I'm more attuned to what happens to them than I am excited about the opportunities that an 18 or 19 year old might have, because these people live with their injuries and they're barely making it. And many of them are impoverished. And in the case of Paul Orndorff, his family couldn't even afford to pay for his funeral. I mean, where's the outrage over that?
Taryn, as the non-wrestling fan among us, I'm curious, and I imagine majority of our listenership are not wrestling fans like Dan and I are. What are your thoughts on how WWE kind of treats its, we'll say, wrestlers, their talents, entertainers? What are your kind of thoughts as the casual fan / non-fan?
Yeah, I think it's a huge miss in terms of PR, and not that dissimilar to how Major League Baseball has treated its minor leaguers. I think that it is in the best interest of these professional sports industries. There's plenty of money. So if any of these teams say that they don't make money, or if wrestling says that they don't make money, it's just not true. So I think that it's a missed opportunity to take good care of them. And in this case, like, how easy is it for Vince McMahon to say, like, I'm not sure how much a funeral costs, but maybe, like, say, here's $50,000 to give him a proper send off. Like, I just don't.
Yeah, I'll say, just because I follow, I'm in the weeds with this stuff, just I don't know why, but, you know, WWE does some stuff that have some really ugly PR ramifications, and then they respond. So, you know, if you've been following WWE, I'm not really sure what's going on over at HQ, but they've fired a lot of prominent wrestlers. Maybe, you know, they're a publicly traded company, and obviously business was probably down because there was no live gates during the pandemic. I was a WWE stockholder for many years, which surprisingly made me a lot of money. I don't know if anybody watches WWE stock. So that was my reintroduction to wrestling. I'm like, if you guys are going to make me money, I'm going to watch your product. But anyway, fast forward, you know, so they fired a lot of wrestlers recently, and in kind of a gross move, if the wrestlers had left some of, you know, some of their possessions, personal stuff, at WWE HQ or at a venue, they were being shipped to the wrestlers, which is not so atypical. The problem is, if you bought social media and what these wrestlers were sending out, they were being sent to wrestlers and Hall of Fame caliber wrestlers like Mickey James and high level player in garbage bags. So people that were really thought of well in the company, if they got fired, they kicked you to the curb and they literally threw your stuff in a garbage bag. So there were some firings internally at WWE for the blowback from that PR. So Taryn, I say it, like, WWE hears the concerns. They hear people like Dan who are on the, you know, soapbox and saying, hey, pay for their funeral expenses. They made you millions. Why don't you throw a couple thousand their way? How about that? So they hear it, but, you know, WWE is a publicly traded company. Again, you know, it's dollars and cents. Someone has viewed the calculus as being not worthy of paying, you know, paying funeral expenses, paying stuff like that. So, yeah, when WWE is done with you, sometimes they adopt you and you become a, you know, an agent and you can help with behind the scenes. And other times they just divorce you and that's it. You have no connection to the sport anymore.
Well, hopefully there'll be a court case. You know, the WWE has been really successful in defending lawsuits brought in the concussion realm and in some of the employee versus independent contractor, you know, context, where these lawsuits are always filed in the District of Connecticut, U.S. District Court for the District of Connecticut, which is the home base for the WWE. And every decision coming out of that court is highly favorable to the WWE. So there's this body of law which has developed in which wrestlers are treated under the law as independent contractors, even though the economic reality and the reality of their professional relationship with the WWE is probably, in my mind, at least, you know, looking at it objectively, it's more akin to an employer-employee relationship when you factor in all of the sort of criteria and elements that go into that kind of analysis, which really is very dependent upon the dominion and control that's exerted by the so-called employer over the employee. And so many of those characteristics would seem to be present here. So maybe it's going to take a revolutionary case along the lines of like the Austin of WWE. Maybe it will be an Austin case-like case with the WWE, or certainly we have a similar case proceeding through the courts, federal court system in Nevada involving the UFC and certain antitrust issues. So, you know, maybe wrestlers will get their day in court where the courts will acknowledge that these fighters and these contestants are more akin to employees than they are to independent contractors. Mm-hmm. These are battles playing out in the rideshare world, in some of the college athletes. This is common in many industries to have these battles over whether someone is an employee or an independent contractor. And to me, they seem more like employees when they're working for the WWE.
Based on how they're being assigned and how they're being organized, it would seem that way. And Dan, you made the point about being a publicly traded company, and that makes sense. And if I'm a stockholder in a publicly traded company, I want the company to do as many acts of goodwill as possible, because that would make the stock more valuable, I think. More people speaking positive financial chatter about a company are going to improve the stock price. But meanwhile, the WWE's stock price is down like 18% over the last month. And I think on the day that Paul Orndorff died, it was at like $56. And today it's at $49. So
Yeah, to your point, you have to watch all these decisions. Business obviously wasn't good for any sports. But here's the thing. I think this is just maybe a final point on WWE. Right? All the sports, our core four sports, our college sports, none of them are publicly traded entities. So we don't know how much money baseball is losing or football is losing. They'll see that in the collective bargaining, you know, debates, how much money was lost, how much money came in. But as a WWE shareholder, you can see how much the gates and the loss of fans really hurt them. So, you know, we'll see how that impacts our other sports. But, you know, WWE is a really good example. They have merchandise, they have concessions, you know, they have television deals. It's an interesting model. So if anybody's really digging in, and I'm sure we'll cover this on a future podcast, the Major League Baseball collective bargaining agreement is expiring very soon. And these same type of issues, how the pandemic, how the last year impacted baseball, is going to come up. So you need some evidence. You're looking for a comparable field. Wrestling's a pretty good bet just okay. In terms of the gate.
I just want to get back to the funeral expenses for Paul Orndorff. He has a GoFundMe page. The goal was $18,000, and it's only right now, it's still $3,000 short of the goal. I think $15,000 is a pretty healthy amount, but it's shocking to me that such a celebrated, you know, major figure in the world of professional wrestling is still short of the fundraising goal on the GoFundMe. And I don't care how many layoffs the WWE has had, paying or contributing $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 to a funeral of one of the legends who helped build your organization. I don't think that can be treated or should be treated as a business decision. It's just the right, honorable, moral, respectable thing to do.
Okay, so we covered a lot. There's some other topics that we're not going to get to, but that's why we have the website, again, conductdetrimental.com. You know, if we've discussed anything in this podcast you disagree with or you want more information on, you're free to write. We tell anyone and everyone, law student, high school, college, lawyer, professor, you are free to write. Partner, we had a partner from Creighton, the lovely state of Nebraska, write a topic for us recently on name, image, and likeness of intellectual property. That's Luke Moorhauser. That's up on the site now. Okay, what to watch for? Taryn, I'm going to kick it to you. We did not really talk about NIL on this, but there's so many fascinating stories popping up. I know you have a good one. Go ahead.
Yeah, so today it was announced that Mikey Williams was a five-star prospect in North Carolina. In the class of 2024, I believe. He's still in high school, but he has reached a deal with Excel Sports Management. They're going to be representing him in one of these marketing deals so that he can take advantage of his name, image, and likeness rights. It's kind of a confluence of very special factors in this case. A friend of the show, Darren Heitner, pointed out that there's no name, image, and likeness law in North Carolina, so there's nothing that regulates whether high school athletes would be able to take advantage of their athletic fame. And so that, combined with the fact that he's going to be playing at Vertical Academy despite attending high school elsewhere, so pretty much a national club team that is based in North Carolina and will have players from all over the country. They're going to be playing all the top high school teams, including Monteverde in Florida, where RJ Barrett went. And so, you know, he's got about 5 million followers on his various social medias. And I think that is going to be highly lucrative for him. And this is really like the first example that we're seeing of a really high level, high profile high school student athlete in the same vein as like a Zion Williamson, and seeing if they would be able to, one, take advantage of this, because the NCAA's interim policy is not banning high school athletes from doing this. It just says that they have to make the school aware. And at the same time, Mikey Williams has been heavily recruited by Overtime and their new Elite League. So it really remains to be seen what will happen going forward, but it's exciting to have somebody test the waters and maybe find out what the market is like for a high-level high school athlete.
From my what to watch for, I think I'd get yelled at if I didn't say this. I am now a two-time girl dad, Sloan Faye Lust. Dan has some objections to the name choice, I guess. But
I love the name choice, Daniel. It's compelling.
We're gonna talk offline. There's some undertones. I'm not sure what they are, but Dan, I'm sticking with it. We already signed it. We already signed the birth certificate. Yeah, Sloan Faye Lust, 7 pounds, 12 ounces. I am so looking forward to all that comes with being a girl dad. Shout out to Rider University. Spoke to the Division I women's basketball program last week, and very sweetly, they sent me a really kind note. about the birth of my daughter, and they gave me a really nice shirt. So obviously, you know, they have secured the top two recruits in the 2041 and 2043 classes. That's Dylan Lust and Sloan Lust. Remember those names, because Taryn in about 20 years is going to be talking about them with their NIL deals. Right, Taryn?
Absolutely. Let's get them signed up now.
Dan, I know we spoke offline. I'm sure there was some sports betting news that we should be on the lookout for.
Yeah, time is drawing near on the United States Department of the Interior's review of the sports betting compact between the state of Florida and the Seminole Tribe of Florida. This deal grants the Seminole Tribe exclusivity over mobile sports betting and off-reservation sports betting, which is basically control over the whole state of Florida. In another week or 2 weeks, we're likely to get a decision from the U.S. Department of the Interior. I expect the agency to approve and sign off on the compact, which will then lead to litigation in the federal courts. There's already one pending lawsuit brought by Magic City Casino and the Bonita Springs Poker Club against Governor DeSantis. I would expect that lawsuit to be amended to include the U.S. Secretary of the Interior. There may be lawsuits filed by DraftKings and FanDuel. So throughout the month of August, we're going to be focusing on whether the U.S. Department of Interior's decision to approve the sports betting compact in Florida violates the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. And the question ultimately will boil down to, does the federal law's requirement that the gaming activity take place on Indian land allow the state and the tribe to enter into a compact for mobile sports betting, which, you know, naturally occurs throughout the state and transcends tribal borders. So I'm looking, at least over the next couple of weeks, for the litigation piece of the Florida compact to heat up, with potentially multiple lawsuits in the federal court system, looking at the Northern District of Florida, maybe the Southern District of Florida, maybe the District of Columbia federal court, as well as the potential for parallel state court litigation over whether sports betting violates the state constitution.
Okay. And I guess we talked a little bit about the NBA finals, just to put a pin in our last week's conversation. Maria Taylor, she had that contract negotiation that was up. She actually is leaving ESPN. That was the news. Yeah. So I guess, you know, if you want to go back to the archives, we do have a lot of good stuff. But again, we'd be remiss if we didn't end on this note. We want to thank all of the lovely contributors to conductdetrimental.com. Again, it is more contributors than our wildest dreams and more views than we've had in our wildest dreams. So,
Dan,
yeah, I don't know, Dan.
The sad thing is our website is now, I think, on par with our podcast. In 1 week, we've generated so much buzz around Conduct Detrimental. I mean, my thank you and my, you know, hats off to all the contributors in my wildest dreams. And that's probably the expression that fits here. I never expected to see as many as 21 contributions in the first week of Conduct Detrimental. This is like a real sports website now. Obviously, all of us are volunteers. You and I are volunteers, but we're all passionate about sports law and what shines through on so many of these articles. And I'm just so blown away that law students and young lawyers are able to really hit the issue effectively, quickly, using, you know, not like 5,000 words. I write multi-thousand word articles, and I've yet to master the art of the 600 to 800 word piece, which is right in the wheelhouse of where you want an article to be on a website like ours. So I've just been really pleasantly surprised and pleased by the quality of articles and contributions that have been made by students all around the country. And we're learning about the talent level and how sharp so many of these students are.
I should say this, and Taryn, I'm going to give you a shout out. I want to speak from the heart in saying this. We have a lot of listeners of the podcast. We had, truthfully, about 100 people reach out with articles, which is a great number, right? And all we're doing, it's a lot. It's a crazy number. But we, and I'm sure there will be more, but all Dan and I and everyone associated with the podcast, we are just existing to pump up your platform. So if you have something that you want to write about, someone gave us this great article and it'll go up in the site, you know, about an issue in lacrosse. I don't follow lacrosse issues. Someone gave us this great issue in the world of golf with Bryson DeChambeau with the Cobra driver. Dan and I don't follow all of these issues, all these sports, but this is all, we've always tried to be the intersection of sports and law and bring people together. All we are here to exist for right now for the website is to get your name out and to show people how smart you are and your writing are. So if you're listening to this podcast and you're like, I don't know, you know, I'll just read them, I won't write them. You know, Taryn, who was on the podcast once upon a time, reached out to me in a very, you know, go-getter type way. And I identified it, you know, same with Stephanie, same with Jason, same with Mike. You reached out and you kind of take the bull by the horn. So if you want to write, I mean, if you're listening to this and you're a law student, I know you like to write. Dan just mentioned, you know, you're basically doing the issue spotting and IRAC-CRAC method. I know my law school terms. I went to law school once upon a time. That's all we want for the website. Yeah. But if you do want to work in sports law, Dan and I have an audience. And just kind of the nature of the beast. Like Dan, you know, Dan's best friends with Clay Travis. I mean, they've gone out to lunch like about 20 times. And, you know, on my end, like, you know, I don't have any heavy hitters like Dan, but I have some people, some different sports networks that read my stuff that are interested in this, like Joe Essis. I'm going to give Joe a quick shout out. Joe said, I have this issue in Texas, Oklahoma. I went through the SEC bylaws. I'm familiar with them. Can I put this article out? And I go, Joe, 100%. And I will get that to where it needs to go. That article in its first couple minutes on the site had about 100 views, and it's getting retweeted, and big people, verified people in my replies are DMing me asking about who Joe Essis is. So that's all we're offering. We just want to put you guys on a platform, and we want to service the sports law market that hasn't existed, you know, in about 2-3 years since the sports law blog, you know, which Michael McCann and Warren Zola, yeah. You know, since that went down. So, I mean, we just want to kind of service the industry.
Dan, I want to say something about sports law blog. I wouldn't be where I am today without the posts that I wrote about Tom Brady and Deflategate. It was Sports Law Blog that basically put me on the map. I was doing sports betting and I was known in that little niche, but certainly not on a national level. And Sports Law Blog did not have the kinds of contributions in terms of frequency that we're now getting at Conduct Detrimental. I mean, maybe there would be a post every couple of days. I know in the early days, there was much more posting, maybe it was daily, but I've never seen anything like this. I think we're now the hub of the US, maybe the international sports law universe. And the great thing about it is there are no barriers to entry. And I tell students all the time, writing and having your point of view, you know, published is the ticket to relevancy, at least in the sports law community early on. Obviously, getting having a position in a firm that does sports work, working for a team, that's all well and good. And that's certainly, those jobs are few and far between. There's zero barriers to entry for writing an article, except having a laptop or computer and internet access. If you want to write something and it's good enough, and you have the kind of passion for the topic, we'll publish it. It takes nothing. So take advantage of the opportunity. And I was afraid at the beginning that, oh my God, we're going to get such, you know, hit and miss kind of stuff. The batting average of the submissions has been, you know, like close to 1,000. It's been perfect. Every article has been, in my view, above the grade of what I've expected and would be if I were running a website professionally. It would be what I would deem publishable. And I wouldn't publish anything that's unpublishable, even on a free website like this, where we don't earn anything. But those articles were good enough to be published anywhere.
So, yeah, I guess, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't shout out Jason Morin, who has been backbone of the website. Sure. You know, Stephanie's been taking the bar. She created the website. But Jason, you know, Jason's been fantastic kind of getting stuff out. You know, and then it takes, Dan, you're promoting tweets. I'm promoting stuff. Taryn, you're out there. So, yeah, it's a whole community. And that's what we're trying to create here.
Conduct Detrimental Sports Law Conference in person.
Dan, let's not put the cart before the horse here. Okay. We just made a website. I just had a child. Let's not start a symposium and a conference. Let's pump the brakes a little, maybe next year. Okay. So I guess as long as your article, somebody asked me today, what are the criterion for posting on the site? I go, don't defame anybody and don't be controversial in a bad way. You can be controversial in a hot take as long as you have some basis, but that's really it. If you think you have any halfway decent writing skill, we will promote it. We'll, as John Nucci knows, I helped him fix up his conclusion a little bit, but his article was fantastic. We just kind of sharpened the edges. That's Dan and I have been, you know, in this space for some time now, and we just want to try to shift your writing from a legal article to kind of a sports law article to reach a casual audience. So I think that's it. Anything else to add, guys, before we put this episode in the books?
Wait, I got a perfect name. The Sloan Sports Conference. Oh, that's taken. That's taken. I'm sorry.
Actually, I put an E at the end of our Sloan because I wanted to separate those two.
We wouldn't have an IP issue then.
Because you can do it. Those are not confusing at all. Those are two very different names. Sloan with an E and without an E. Shout out to one of my favorite shows growing up, Entourage, if you wanted to get some of the inspiration for that name. Okay, so Dan, as always, is at Wallach Legal on social media. Myself, Dan Lust, at Sports All Lust. Taryn is at TK Sharma Law. Mike, our backbone of the podcast, our podcast producer, is at Mike_SonOfLaw. Stephanie Weissberger _ and Jason, we'll give Jason a shout out, is at Jay Moore. But yeah, at some point, you guys are just going to know those handles. We don't need to keep shouting them out. And with that said, definitely take a look at the conductdetrimental.com website, up and running, buzzing, doing real well. And yeah, we will see you next week on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.